Good evening, brethren. I'd like to invite you to turn in your Bibles to Deuteronomy chapter 16. Deuteronomy 16. I appreciate so much the invitation to be with you tonight, this entire weekend, to be able to speak to you about drawing near to the cross. It's good to see so many of you, visitors, people that I've known from years past. Always good to make connections again. Tonight was the only night my wife was going to be able to join us, but she was not able to do so. And that is why I am not wearing a jacket, because if she had been here, then I would not have forgotten it. It is truly not good for man to be alone, folks. She would have helped me out immensely with that. People enjoy usually seeing her more than me anyway. So, Mary Annette, can you believe that our dog Uncle Baby is still alive? She won't die for some reason, and she's gotten that separation anxiety, and we can't leave her alone for a long period of time. That's why she had to stay. I tell you what, furry kids, you know. Deuteronomy 16, really glad to be here. Have some more things I want to say, but I have a lot I want to talk with you about tonight, so I'll save some of that for tomorrow night and Sunday. The trial of Jesus of Nazareth was one of the greatest scandals in all of human history. There's never been a trial with more deliberate disregard for rules of procedure or one filled with more conspiracy, animosity, and corruption. There were laws in place at that time that should have protected Jesus and assured him a fair trial, but these rights were trampled upon. And the very ones who violated the law throughout this trial were the ones who were entrusted with enforcing the law and preventing injustice. In Deuteronomy chapter 16, in verse 18 through 20, Moses said in that passage, "You shall appoint for yourself judges and officers in all your towns, which the Lord your God has given you, according to your tribes, and they shall judge the people with righteous judgment. You shall not distort justice, you shall not be partial, and you shall not take a bribe. For a bribe blinds the eyes of the wise and perverts the words of the righteous. Justice and only justice you shall pursue, that you may live and possess the land which the Lord your God is giving you." There we have God's standard for judgment and justice for the Jews. Local judges judging the people with fairness and righteousness, never distorting what is true, never being partial or taking a bribe. They were to pursue justice so that they could possess the land that God was giving them. But the Jews of Jesus' day had concocted a plan against him that was a mockery of Jewish law, because no one was ever more innocent and no one ever stood before a more illegal and unfair trial than he did. When we combine the gospel records of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, we find that there were six distinct phases to the trial. First of all, there were three Hebrew trials, three that were all Jewish. The first phase, which was the one that was before Annas, the second phase of which was before the high priest of that time, Caiaphas, and the third being before the great Sanhedrin. And then the last three phases of the trial were predominantly Roman, the first of which was before Pilate, the second before King Herod, and then the third of which was before Pilate again. I think that understanding the shameful and the very brazen violations against our Lord during his trial actually adds another dimension to the tragedy that was his crucifixion. And hopefully this will inspire a more appreciative love on our part for what Jesus did for us in his humility, in his endurance on the cross that he portrayed, while certainly being subject to such injustice. And so I want to talk with you tonight about the six phases of this trial. Let's begin by talking about Annas, first of all. In John chapter 18, beginning in verse 12 and 13, it says that they led Jesus to Annas first, for he was father-in-law of Caiaphas, who was the high priest that year. Now, Annas had been the chief priest in Israel from 7 A.D. to 15 A.D., according to history. And so he would have actually been high priest during the time that a young Jesus taught the priests in the temple in Luke chapter 2. History tells us that Annas had the reputation of being a very wicked, corrupt, and a very adulterous leader. He was eventually removed by the Romans, actually, in 15 A.D., because he had carried out a death sentence without asking permission of the Romans. But when he was removed, he would begin a dynasty in which, as you see on the slide, five of his sons would also eventually become high priests, and then his son-in-law Caiaphas would as well. And though Annas had been removed in 15 A.D., Luke chapter 3 and verse 2 tells us that it was a joint high priesthood between Annas and Caiaphas, and Annas was certainly, as we see in Scripture, adept at exercising his authority in the Sanhedrin. Annas was patriarch of what was called the House of Hanan. And that was one of the most influential families in the Jewish nation. The House of Hanan operated four stores that sold the legally pure sacrificial animals at the temple. And they were called the four shops under the twin cedars. See, at Passover, what you had happen is you had thousands upon thousands of Jews that would gather from their four nations to Jerusalem to offer sacrifices, and they would bring with them their foreign currencies from their respective nations. But foreign currencies weren't accepted in the temple, and so what the House of Hanan would do, they would set up money booths right there in the temple to exchange. They did this right in the court of the temple. And so in addition to the annual temple tax, these exchanges made Annas a very rich man, and Annas was only going to stay a very rich man by continuing this little enterprise. Now, knowing that, can you deduce what actions on Jesus' part probably caused Annas to go after him with such ferocity? Sure we can. In John chapter 2, verse 13 through 16, Jesus cleanses the temple, turning over the money changers' tables, and then 3 years later, as we see on the slide here in Matthew 21, he does it again. These actions made Jesus a marked man in the sight of Annas and his family. And so when Jesus is brought before Annas, I want you to notice the first thing that happens here in John 18 and verse 19. It says, the high priest then questioned Jesus about his disciples and about his teaching. Now, what I think Annas is trying to do here, though it's not explicitly said, is I think Annas is trying to get Jesus to self-incriminate himself, to intimidate him into talking so that he can use something that Jesus says against him. But Jesus doesn't take the bait. Jesus knew his rights. According to the Mishnah, an accused person could neither be compelled nor required to testify against himself. Now, he could be encouraged or permitted to offer testimony on his own behalf, but he could not be compelled to do so. So in Annas asking Jesus about his doctrine, what he's trying to do is illegally use Jesus' testimony alone to convict him. But rather than taking the bait, Jesus challenges Annas to produce a witness, which was his right. The Jewish laws for procedure, evidence, and witnesses, as the Mishnah would later record, require that any charge or any accusation, it has to be brought before witnesses. Jesus knew this, and so here is his response in verse 20. He says, I have spoken openly to the world. I always taught in synagogues and in the temple where all the Jews come together, and I spoke nothing in secret. Why do you question me? Question those who have heard what I spoke to them. They know what I said. Now, that's a very fair question. You know, Jesus never did what false teachers typically do, winning over disciples in secret and skulking around in the darkness. No, Jesus preached openly to anyone who would listen. And he was often heard even by members of the Sanhedrin itself. There was a vast scope of witnesses to choose from, and any of them, especially those who had benefited from Jesus' miracles or even benefited from his teaching, would have been more than happy to testify on his behalf. See, under Jewish law, an accusing witness together with two eyewitnesses were always required for a conviction. Deuteronomy 19 verse 15 says that a single witness shall not rise up against a man on account of any iniquity or any sin which he has committed. on the evidence of two or three witnesses, a matter shall be confirmed. And Annas knew this, but he produced not one credible witness because he wasn't interested in justice. He wanted to bring Jesus instead to a humiliating end. And so in John 18 and verse 22, it says that when Jesus had said this, one of the officers standing nearby struck Jesus, saying, "Is that the way you answer the high priest?" And this proves right here that though Annas was not really high priest, he was an extremely powerful man who still held sway over many who considered him to be God's true high priest. But Jesus had not been insolent when he said this. All Jesus had done is he pointed out that Annas was obligated under Jewish law to follow the correct procedures. And so he says in verse 23, "If I have spoken wrongly, testify of the wrong. But if rightly, why do you strike me?" In other words, why are you striking me for asking for my legal rights? But see, Annas wasn't interested in legality. All he wanted was a one-on-one with Jesus where he could abuse him and where he could mistreat him. And having done so, he ships him off for round two. John 18, verse 24 says that, "So Annas sent him bound to Caiaphas." Now, 3 years after Annas was removed from office in 15 A.D., Caiaphas was appointed high priest in 18 A.D. because he had married Annas' daughter, thus becoming Annas' son-in-law. Caiaphas would reign as high priest for almost 19 years, the longest by far of any high priest that reigned in Jerusalem during the entire first century. And so the fact that Caiaphas was able to retain this position for so long, it actually speaks to his shrewdness and it speaks to his ability to conform well to the requirements of Rome. But by this time in history, there was nothing holy about the position of high priest. Those appointed often bowed themselves to things like nepotism, to money, and personal interest. Mark 14:53 says they led Jesus away to the high priest, and all the chief priests and the elders and the scribes gathered together. Now, based on the wording of this verse, it is likely that a quorum of at least 23 members of the great Sanhedrin were present in Caiaphas' palace. That they are readily available so late at night is evidence that they planned Jesus' arrest and that they needed to come up with a crime to charge him with before taking him to Pilate in the morning. At the time of a Jewish trial, it was always the duty of the presiding officer of the court to remind any witnesses present about the value of life and to warn them not to forget anything that might be in the accused's favor. But Caiaphas neglected that responsibility as he, like Annas, had no intention whatsoever of being fair to Jesus. His intention, as Annas's was to have Jesus murdered. And so Mark 14, verse 55 says, "Now the chief priests and the whole council kept trying to obtain testimony against Jesus to put him to death, and they were not finding any." So their attempts to find false witnesses was there, but what we see in verse 56 is that it actually backfired. It says, "For many were giving false testimony against him, but their testimony was not consistent." Now, brethren, this is really, really interesting because Deuteronomy actually gave instruction on what you were supposed to do if witnesses at any time falsely testified or if there was evidence that they had falsely testified. We already read in Deuteronomy 19:15 that two or three witnesses were required. But then after verse 15, the verses go on to explain what should happen if the witnesses turned out to be false. Verse 16 says, "If a malicious witness rises up against a man to accuse him of wrongdoing, then both the men who have the dispute shall stand before the Lord, before the priests and the judges who will be in office in those days. The judges shall investigate thoroughly, and if the witness is a false witness and he has accused his brother falsely, then you shall do to him just as he had intended to do to his brother. Thus you shall purge the evil from among you. The rest will hear and be afraid and will never again do such an evil thing among you. Thus you shall not show pity. Life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot." But we don't see this procedure in this second phase of the trial. Because if Caiaphas were to follow this procedure to its ultimate conclusion, he'd have to apply it to himself, wouldn't he? Christ listened to the testimony of these false witnesses, but he did not respond to them. And it appears that this silence angered Caiaphas, roused him. Because in verse 62 of Matthew 26, it says, "The high priest stood up and said to him, 'Do you not answer it? What is it that these men are testifying against you?' But Jesus kept silent. And the high priest said to him, 'I adjure you by the living God that you tell us whether you are the Christ, the Son of God.'" Now, the literal Greek that is used here for the phrase, "I adjure you," means that he is charging Christ under oath to answer the question. But this was illegal, because the accused was never to be compelled to testify against himself. If he did decide to, it can never form the basis of a conviction. But perhaps knowing that his conviction was certain, Christ answers in the affirmative, saying in verse 64, "You have said it yourself. Nevertheless, I tell you, hereafter you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of power and coming on the clouds of heaven." Now, what Caiaphas does next is another gross illegality. In verse 65, we read that the high priest tore his robes and said, "He has blasphemed. What further need do we have of witnesses? Behold, you have now heard the blasphemy. What do you think?" And they answered, "He deserves death." Now, we recognize that the hypocrisy is sickening, of course, that Caiaphas was so seemingly appalled by Jesus' apparent blasphemy that he'd actually tear his clothes, yet he isn't disgusted with his own scheming and his own witnesses. But this was all show. What this tearing, this rending of his garments was, is it was an overly dramatic act designed to secure the death verdict that he desired for Jesus. See, according to the Mishnah, the correct procedure for reaching a verdict was accomplished by polling each single member of the Sanhedrin in order, from most junior to most senior member, then ending with the high priest. Now, the reason that they had decided to do this is so that the ones with more seniority could not influence those with lesser seniority. So by starting with the juniors and then ending with the high priest, it would assure a more fairer and more impartial vote. And so when Caiaphas stood up and he tore his clothes, announcing his verdict of guilty, that act alone guaranteed that he was going to secure the vote that he desired. Because not many were going to stand against someone that was as shrewd and as powerful as Caiaphas. So in verse 67, we read, "Then they spat in his face and beat him with their fists. And others slapped him and said, 'Prophesy to us, you Christ. Who is the one who hit you?'" The hypocrisy is just overwhelming. Jesus never had a chance for a fair, unbiased, impartial trial. Now, in phase three, Jesus is going to be brought before the entire Sanhedrin. This is now the next morning. And before we talk about this phase, I want to make sure we understand how judicial law and judgment was supposed to be enacted by the Jews during that day. We already read in Deuteronomy 16, verse 18 through 20 earlier, that there were to be local judges who judged the people with fairness and righteousness so that they would be able to live in the land that God had secured for them. Now, as time went by from when this verse was written back in the wilderness, the Jews set out to apply these verses within their society. And here's how they ended up doing it. When a region or a locality in Israel had at least 120 men who were heads of families, then you would have a local council of judges that would form, like lower tribunals, called Sanhedrins. The word Sanhedrin literally means sitting together. That's what the word means, sitting together. In other words, these were a group of men who came and sat together to decide judgments in civil and in criminal issues. Now, then they were in the larger towns, or what would be called lesser Sanhedrin. And the lesser Sanhedrins were always composed of 23 men, what is called a quorum. This is always an odd number because it was to guarantee or assure a majority vote. And these men were typically taken from the elders of that community, where they acted as judges and jury in all cases. Now, since Jerusalem was the capital city of Israel, they had what was called the Great Sanhedrin. This council was composed of 70 men, patterned exactly after the council that Moses established, that group of judges he established in the wilderness. And these 70 men were divided into three quorums. You had 23 priests who were called chief priests. So when you read in the New Testament about chief priests, that's what they were a part of. Then you had 23 scribes. And then you had 24 elders. And then the high priest was added to that 70 to make 71 so that you could get that odd number that you were looking for. The chief priests were filled exclusively by the high priest. The chamber of scribes included people like Levite doctors and laymen who were educated from the law. And then the chamber of elders was comprised mostly of elderly and well-respected men of the nation of Israel. The Great Sanhedrin in Jerusalem, it was the final court of appeal, very similar to our Supreme Court. The lesser Sanhedrins would have been similar to the Supreme Courts in our counties, and then those lower tribunals would be analogous to our city's Justice of the Peace Courts. Any person in Israel who felt that the judgment made at a lower level council was not fair could appeal to the Great Sanhedrin in Jerusalem, and then under certain conditions they could be granted a hearing. They were the highest ruling body in all of Israel, and being a member of the Great Sanhedrin was considered one of the highest honors that a Jewish male could attain to. But when Israel became an occupied state, the Roman governors began appointing and removing members of the Sanhedrin, and this led it to becoming extremely corrupt. And yet, despite this, the Sanhedrin was supposed to provide guarantees to an accused person. First, the accused person was guaranteed a public trial. Nothing secret or covert. Nothing at night, in other words. Everything was to be open. Everything was to be exposed so that nobody could be framed or railroaded into an execution or penalty that wasn't fair. Secondly, the Sanhedrin guaranteed the accused the right of self-defense. There was to be someone who provided a defense for the accused, and he also had the right to assign that defense for himself from the mouths of other witnesses who could then participate in the trial. And then third, there was to be no conviction unless proven guilty by two or three witnesses, as we read in Deuteronomy 19 and verse 15. Now, the very reason that the Great Sanhedrin saw the need to hold this third phase of Jesus' trial speaks volumes to the fact that they knew what they had done to him the night before was illegal. And no verdict was to be recognized by the Romans until an official hearing took place anyway in front of the Sanhedrin during daylight hours. And so all they are wanting to do in this third phase of the trial is they're wanting to give the appearance of legality so that when they brought Jesus before Pilate, they'll have a better chance of convicting him to give the okay to have him crucified. And so in Luke chapter 22 and verse 66, we read that when it was day, the council of elders of the people assembled, both chief priests and scribes, and they led him away to their council chamber. Now, this third phase, as recorded in the Gospels, is very brief, as it's recorded. And there is a bit of repetitiveness to it, simply because they want to be able to convince anyone who wasn't present from the night before of Jesus' so-called blasphemy. And so the high priest, without bringing any evidence forward, without providing Jesus counsel whatsoever, proceed once again to try to self-incriminate Jesus by saying in verse 67, "If you are the Christ, tell us." But Jesus had already been through this with them the night before, hadn't he? He had gotten nowhere with them. And that's exactly why he says what he does here. He says, "If I tell you, you will not believe. And if I ask a question, you will not answer." And of course he's right. They didn't care who he was. They only wanted him dead to spare their nation from the Romans and to maintain control, their control, over the populace. Jesus has spent over 3 years producing miracle after miracle and confounding them with teaching that surpassed that of even the greatest rabbis. But they were indifferent to the evidence. And so in verse 69 he says, "But from now on, the Son of Man will be seated at the right hand of the power of God." And I think probably the idea is he's saying, you're not going to get it until it's too late. By the time you realize who I am, I will have been given all power and authority. But of course, his answer wasn't sufficient enough for them to gain the confession that they needed for a guilty verdict. And so they pressed him further in verse 70. And they all said, "Are you the Son of God?" And then verse 70 and 71, he said to them, "Yes, I am." Then they said, "What further need do we have of testimony? For we have heard it ourselves from his own mouth." Now, before we look at the three Roman trials, I want to just quickly, very quickly, show you the many, many laws in these Jewish trials that were violated, documented by the Hebrew rules of procedure, evidence, and witnesses from the mission. And for time's sake, we're not going to go through these with detail, but I am going to display them on the screen. If anybody wants a copy of this PowerPoint, I'll be glad to give it to them later, as they're all documented with references here. But as already mentioned, the accused could not be compelled to testify against himself. Two or three witnesses were always required to convict and must agree on all essential details, otherwise their testimony was going to be rejected. Jesus was questioned at night, which was illegal because nothing could convene between the evening and the morning sacrifices. The accused must be treated humanely, which he was not. All trials were required to take place in the chamber of hewn stones, which is this, on the north wall of the temple. And of course, the first two phases of the trial did not take place there. It took place in Annas' house and in Caiaphas' house. In the first trial, Jesus was not questioned before a quorum. Jesus was questioned on the day of a Passover feast and on the eve of a Jewish Sabbath, and that was illegal as well. The indictment against Jesus was actually originated by the Sanhedrin, which prevented them from being unbiased judges. And the law specifically stated that there were to be no prejudiced judges. That shouldn't have qualified them from being from initiating the interrogation to begin with. They convicted Jesus based on his uncorroborated confession. The law of Moses specifically forbade the high priest from tearing his clothes. That's from Leviticus 21 and verse 10. And Caiaphas did that. The balloting was irregular, as we discussed. It was supposed to be from junior to senior. It appears that of those present, it was a unanimous verdict of guilty, which should have set Jesus free. That's really interesting. The law said it could not be unanimous. And it appears it was. I've always wondered, where was Nicodemus? Where was Joseph of Arimathea? We're not told. But I've been in these things long enough to know that sometimes good men will sit on their hands and do nothing. And I don't know that that happened with them. But where were they? I've always wondered that. And if the death sentence was announced, as it was in that third trial, a second trial was required to be held the next day. And we see that that did not happen. It's remarkable, isn't it? How unjust and how unfair these Jewish trials were. Let's go to the Roman trials. Now, the Sanhedrin, they wanted to put Jesus to death, but they did not have the authority to do so. Because at this stage in history, Israel was no longer a sovereign state. They were an occupied people. Pompey the Great was the ruler of Rome that conquered Palestine in 63 BC, and that began the 700-year rule by the Romans over this area. And when he died, Gaius Julius Caesar assumed the title of emperor until he was assassinated in 44 BC. Before he was assassinated, though, he actually ordered the post-mortem adoption of Gaius Octavius and designated him to be his heir, and this adopted heir to the throne would then assume the name Augustus Caesar. And Augustus Caesar would first rule Rome alongside Lepidus and Mark Antony, the one of Cleopatra fame, until 15 years later he became the sole ruler of Rome from 31 BC to 14 AD, which means that he was the one who was ruler overlapping Jesus' birth. Now, Augustus Caesar's family was filled with controversy. His only child was a daughter named Julia, And he then forced his stepson, Tiberius, to divorce his wife and marry his stepsister, Julia. And Tiberius and Julia, they were extremely unhappy, so unhappy that Julia eventually had an affair with a Roman soldier and gave birth to a child from this affair by the name of Claudia. And when Augustus died, Tiberius ruled Rome from 14 AD to 37 AD and was therefore the ruler of the Roman Empire during this very trial that we're talking about tonight. One of the things that Tiberius decided to do to maintain control over its client states was to appoint governors throughout the territories. Claudia had married a Roman by the name of Pontius Pilate. And since Tiberius was a suspicious ruler, he wanted Claudia and her bad influence out of Rome, as far away from Rome as possible. And so Tiberius appointed Pilate as the fifth governor over Palestine, and we find him in that rule as our Lord began the fourth phase of his trial. We read in Luke 23 and verse 1 that the whole body of them got up and brought him before Pilate. Now, and some of this is going to be history that I'm going to give you here, as I've already done, but prior Palestinian governors, according to history, had been extremely careful not to offend the Jews. But Pilate wasn't satisfied with his appointment because it wasn't considered prestigious and it left him feeling disconnected from Rome. And so Pilate actually brought a lot of bitterness to the position that hindered him from having the kind of political discretion that he needed to be successful in Palestine. He began, according to history, his rule in Jerusalem by taking images and just emblazoning them all over the palace, something that previous governors had avoided because of the Jews' devotion to the Ten Commandments, of course. We understand from history that the Jews petitioned for him to remove those images, but he wouldn't listen, and then he intimidated them or threatened them with death if they wouldn't stop bothering him about it. But the Jews, according to history, actually called his bluff in open defiance. They threw themselves to the ground and they laid bare their necks to the Roman sword, preferring to die rather than to violate their sacred laws. And so Pilate was outmaneuvered. And so rather than killing them and inciting a riot, he yielded to their will and he withdrew all those images and standards that he set up at the beginning of his reign. But then in a further attempt to establish his authority, Pilate later adorned his palace with gilded shields in dedication to Tiberius Caesar, trying to win some favor from the Caesar at that time. But rather than going to Pilate about this again, the Jews actually circumvented Pilate by petitioning directly to Tiberius, telling Tiberius that these shields were hung less for his honor than it was just to annoy the Jews. And Tiberius granted their request and ordered Pilate to remove the shield from his palace in Jerusalem. As procurator, Pilate was an extension of Tiberius Caesar and did not want to displease him. And Tiberius, according to history, was a very paranoid and overly suspicious ruler, and so Pilate knew that he needed to be careful. But the Jews also knew this about Tiberius. And because of that, the Jews were able to capitalize on Pilate's fear to achieve their own end. All of this is to show, brethren, as we get into this fourth phase of the trial, that Pilate was a weak leader, very weak. And this weakness would actually come back to bite him during Jesus' trial as it affected his ability to enforce his will against the Jews. In John 18, verse 28, it says that they led Jesus from Caiaphas into the praetorium, and it was early. And they themselves did not enter into the praetorium so that they would not be defiled but might eat the Passover. Well, considering the last 12 hours were replete with their cruelty, illegalities, and conspiracy to commit murder, it's really absurd that they were so concerned with being ritually pure enough to eat the Passover feast. But, you know, I know it's a speculation, but I suspect Pilate was probably aware of how hypocritically devout these Jewish leaders could be. And so in John 18, verse 29 through 30, it says that Pilate went out to them and said, "What accusation do you bring against this man?" And they answered and said to him, "If this man were not an evildoer, we would not have delivered him to you." Now, their response implies that they did not expect to be questioned regarding their charge. And if that's the case, it's possible that Pilate had actually cooperated with the arrest of Jesus by lending them Roman soldiers. So it's possible the Jews expected Pilate to condone the death penalty without question, though I suppose that's speculative on my part. But Pilate did not acquiesce, because in verse 31, it says that Pilate said to them, "Take him yourselves and judge him according to your law." And the Jews said to him, "We are not permitted to put anyone to death." Now, Roman trials were a lot simpler and a lot more streamlined than Jewish trials. There were generally three distinct parts to a Roman trial. First, there was the accusation. This had to be made by a private citizen. It would be similar to someone filing a complaint in a court of law. Second, there was the inquiry. This was an examination of the accusation made that included listening to the accuser and considering his defense. And then third, there was the tribunal's judgment. And this is important. All judgments by the tribunal were to be final. Remember that, because that's going to come back here in just a moment. Now, since the Jews were an occupied people, they did not have the right of executing. They could condemn Jesus to death, but only Rome reserved the right to carry out the sentence. And so whatever verdict they agreed on after a religious trial, they were going to have to try to find a way to sell Pilate on that verdict. And they weren't going to be able to sell a pagan like Pilate on the death penalty with a charge of blasphemy. I mean, the Romans worshipped many gods. The emperors even declared themselves gods so that people would continue to worship them long after they were dead. So the Romans didn't recognize such a crime as blasphemy. And so what the Jews do is they actually change the accusation to something that they think they then might be able to sell Pilate on. And so in Luke 23 and verse 2, it says, "They began to accuse him, saying, 'We found this man misleading our nation and forbidding to pay taxes to Caesar, and saying that he himself is Christ, the King.'" Now, this satisfied the first part of the three parts of the Roman trial called the accusation. And all three charges that they're bringing to Pilate are political. They're not religious. In order to pass Jesus off, not as a blasphemer, but as an actual threat to Rome and a threat to Caesar's authority. And of course, they were absurd, all three charges. And the first two charges, according to the text, those don't seem to faze Pilate all that much. He already judged the Jews as being perverse to the ways of the Romans. And he didn't seem to really care about the charge that Jesus forbade tribute to Caesar. However, Pilate did show interest in the third accusation, that Jesus claimed to be king. Because when he brings Christ into the judgment hall, he does inquire of Jesus concerning this charge. In John 18, verse 33, it says, "Therefore Pilate entered again into the praetorium and summoned Jesus and said to him, 'Are you the King of the Jews?' And Jesus, again, he just displays his matchless brilliance by answering Pilate's questions with one of his own. 'Are you saying this on your own initiative? Or did others tell you about me?'" So what Jesus is doing here is he's working on Pilate. He wants to know who or what inspired Pilate's question. Exactly what did Pilate mean? Was Pilate speaking temporally or was he speaking spiritually? Pilate's response, though, indicates that he was only speaking temporally, saying in verse 35, "I'm not a Jew, am I? Your own nation and chief priest delivers you to me. What have you done?" Christ, of course, had the ability to answer life-threatening questions with the simplest of truths, saying in verse 36, "My kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, then my servants would be fighting so that I would not be handed over to the Jews. But as it is, my kingdom is not of this realm." So Pilate wanted to be certain. And so in verse 37, he said to him, "So you are a king." And Jesus answered, "You say correctly that I am a king. For this reason I have been born, for this I have come into the world, to testify to the truth. Everyone who is of the truth hears my voice." And of course, not recognizing that he is standing before the embodiment and the personification of truth, Pilate asks the skeptical, oft-repeated question, "What is truth?" But while he didn't recognize Jesus as being the truth, he also didn't seem to think the Jews' accusation held any weight. And so, fulfilling the second part of the Roman trial, inquiry, he brings them out again in verse 38. And he says, "I find no guilt in him." Rendering his judgment now, Pilate has fulfilled all three parts of the Roman trial. And since Pilate was the extension of Tiberius Caesar himself, his authority was absolute. Pilate's verdict was an acquittal, and Christ should have been set free, and any future proceedings on those same charges should have been illegal. And that's what we call double jeopardy. But Pilate's pronouncement of innocence, unfortunately, caused too much consternation among the chief priests who were just lusting after Christ's blood. And Pilate was too weak of a leader to stand against him. And so in Luke 23, verse 5, we read that Pilate is going to look for an out, because he realizes that he's rendered his judgment that he's about to cause a riot. And so he hears this in verse 5. That the Jews kept on insisting, saying, "He stirs up the people, teaching all over Judea, starting with Galilee, even as far as this place." And now Pilate is thinking, here's a way out. Here's a way out. Jurisdiction. Luke 23, verse 6 and 7 says that when Pilate heard it, he asked whether the man was a Galilean. And when he learned that he belonged to Herod's jurisdiction, he sent him to Herod, who himself was in Jerusalem at that time. Now, this is very typical of jurisprudence. You were supposed to be tried by the authorities in your own region. Jesus was a Galilean. The ruler of Galilee was Herod Antipas. And so Pilate, he thinks, this is my way out. I don't have to deal with this anymore. I'll ship him off to Herod over there at the Hasmonean Palace. That's Herod's crib in Jerusalem. And this begins what we call the fifth phase of the trial of Jesus. Who was Herod Antipas? Now, while Israel was an occupied nation, the Romans granted some latitude to the Jews to govern themselves internally. A man by the name of Antipater, who was an Arab sheik of Edomite heritage, had at one time provided military aid to Augustus Caesar, and Augustus Caesar rewarded this aid to him by crowning his son Herod over Israel in 37 B.C., But that title apparently wasn't glamorous enough for Herod, and so Herod himself dubbed himself Herod the Great. Herod the Great had several wives, but one in particular was a woman by the name of Mariamne II. She was the daughter of the high priest of that time, Simon Maccabee. And that name may sound familiar to you. He was a very influential man. This was a very popular Jewish family at that time period, the Maccabees. And so this made Herod two things. It made him a nominal Jewish convert, but since the Maccabees were a patriotic force, this marriage also added to the power Herod had already been granted by the Romans. The Jews actually despised Herod the Great, though he did help them rebuild their temple. He was despised by them, and he was despised by them for good reason. When Jesus was born, as we know, Herod ordered the heartless murdering of all children in Bethlehem and along the coast from 2 years old and under, fearing that his throne would be taken away by this king of the Jews. We know from history that thousands of Pharisees were put to death by him for refusing to swear allegiance to the emperor and to Herod, and he also had every Sadducee killed except for one member. During Herod the Great's time, citizens were forbidden to assemble together. They were forbidden to hold public meetings or even to walk together on the streets for fear of an uprising. Herod the Great had seven members of his own family, including three of his sons and one of his wives, as well as their mother, murdered. And he also had 45 members of that very popular Maccabean family that he had married to, murdered. He was so despicable, Augustus Caesar would later remark that he'd rather be a pig in Herod's court than be one of his sons. When Herod the Great finally died, though, his kingdom was divided into three of the surviving sons, Archelaus, Philip, and Antipas. They would be referred to as tetrarchs. But when Archelaus died, Antipas thought that his brother's kingdom, which included Judea, should go to him, but Rome instead granted Judea to Pilate. And this is most likely the beginning of that animosity that the gospel accounts say existed between Herod Antipas and Pilate. Herod Antipas ruled the Jews for 43 years. And he was cruel, he was sly, he was just as ambitious as his dad, though probably not as much. History tells us that he was a drunkard and as morally corrupt as an individual as you would ever find. At some point, we know that he visited his brother Herod Philip in Rome, but we learn from Scripture that he wasn't interested in his brother as much as he was interested in his brother's wife, whose name was Herodias. Herodias was not only Herod Philip's wife, but she was also his niece. And so when Herod Antipas took her from his brother, he not only entered into an adulterous marriage, he entered into an incestuous one as well. And he flaunted it shamelessly. He flaunted it openly and publicly. It was in all the Galilean tabloids. And so John the Baptist let him have it. We read in Matthew 14, 3 and 4 that when Herod had John arrested, he bound him and put him in prison because of Herodias, the wife of his brother Philip, for John had been saying to him, "It is not lawful for you to have her." And Luke 4, verse 19 says that John not only rebuked him for this unlawful marriage, but because of all the wicked things that Herod had done. But putting John in prison wasn't enough for Herodias, who no doubt took John the Baptist's rebuke personally. She didn't want John the Baptist in prison. She wanted him dead. So the story in Matthew 14 tells us that Herod Antipas, after he was throwing a birthday party for himself, the daughter of Herodias began dancing before Herod. This was no doubt a seductive dance designed to further weaken the resolve of an already inebriated Herod. And so seduced by her, he tells her to ask of him anything she wanted up to half his kingdom. And prompted by her mother Herodias, she asked for the head of John the Baptist on a platter. And though grieved by the request, Herod granted it to her. And the reason I'm giving you this background is so that you can understand the kind of family that we're talking about here, these Herodians. Adultery, the divorce, incest, seduction, and murder. Herod had longed to meet Jesus according to Scripture, and he finally gets his opportunity in this fifth phase of the trial. Luke 23 and verse 8 says that Herod was glad when he saw Jesus, for he had wanted to see him for a long time because he had been hearing about him and was hoping to see some sign performed by him. Notice that he was glad only because he wanted to be entertained by Jesus and for no other reason. He believed Jesus to be nothing more than a circus monkey to be entertained with fancy tricks. But Herod had concerns that Jesus was John the Baptist resurrected, so this would have given him the opportunity to put Jesus to death and relax his superstition had he chosen to do so. So in verse 9, it says that he questioned him at some length, but he answered him nothing. Jesus never said one word to Herod, not a word. He stands there as silent as a lamb. And this must have driven an egotistical maniac like Herod crazy. I mean, men bowed to Herod. And innocent men wasted no time begging for mercy in front of authority figures such as himself. But Jesus doesn't do that. Jesus doesn't defend himself. He says not one word. Maybe it was his disdain for Herod and all the atrocities he had committed, or maybe it was because he knew that nothing he could ever say to that man would ever make a dent in his heart. See, he worked on Pilate a little bit, but he would not say one word to Herod. Or maybe he's just resigned to his fate. We really don't know. But in verse 10, it says that the chief priests and the scribes were standing there accusing him vehemently. You know, interestingly, with Herod being both a Roman tetrarch as well as the king of the Jews, Jesus could have been charged both with sedition and blasphemy. But Herod wasn't in Galilee. He was visiting Jerusalem. And so Christ was not really in Herod's jurisdiction for him to really do anything legally to Christ. And this is probably the main illegality associated with this particular phase of the trial, in that a person could only be tried within the jurisdiction from which he had come. But the chief priests and scribes are vehemently accusing Jesus. And anyone who is a real judge would have slapped that gravel down and yelled, "Order in the courts!" But no such order was encouraged. Herod had seen no evidence. He had heard no evidence, heard no testimony from witnesses on Jesus' behalf, and had no proof of any criminal act on Jesus' part. All he saw standing before him was a bloodied and bruised man who had been up all night, spit and blood matting his hair, his eyes sunken, his face bruised with blows and swollen. This is no revolutionary. He's bound. Where is his armor? Where are his weapons? This is that Jesus that I've heard so much about. This is no miracle worker. He's a nobody. What a joke. I imagine him thinking. And so rather than giving him a fair trial, Herod joins the scorn of the council by mocking Jesus. Verse 11, we read that Herod, with his soldiers, after treating him with contempt and mocking him, dressed him in a gorgeous robe and sent him back to Pilate. Now, we know this, but he wasn't honoring Jesus, wasn't honoring him by dressing him in a gorgeous robe. He is making him into a caricature. Only people seeking the office or presently in the office would be so arrayed. Herod is mocking Jesus by presenting him as nothing more than a pretender to the crown. And that seems to have changed the relationship between Pilate and Herod, because verse 12 says, now Herod and Pilate became friends with one another that very day, for before they had been enemies with each other. And so whatever decency Pilate may have had to try and do whatever he could to free Jesus, let this first be a reminder of who it is that we're actually dealing with in that Roman governor. So Herod sends Jesus back to Pilate, and with what decision? What verdict? Luke 23, verse 13 says that Pilate summoned the chief priests and the rulers and the people and said to them, you brought this man to me as one who incites the people to rebellion, and behold, having examined him before you, I have found no guilt in this man regarding the charges which you make against him. No, nor has Herod, for he sent him back to us. And behold, nothing deserving death has been done by him. In other words, Herod confirmed Pilate's judgment. As wicked as he was, he confirmed Pilate's judgment, not guilty. These are two judges, two witnesses, the two supreme political powers in Israel, both having examined Jesus and declared him not guilty. And so we come to the final phase. The final phase. Pilate knows that these envious Jews won't accept Pilate or Herod's verdicts. And so Pilate is going to try to do what I think are three things to try to achieve Jesus' release. And these three things we're going to talk about, I'm going to try to talk about them very quickly, are in no particular order, as the gospel accounts make the order slightly difficult to grasp in some areas. But I will discuss them in the order that seems to make the most sense. First, Pilate is going to uphold a Roman tradition by offering to release a prisoner for Passover. John 18, verse 39, he says to them, but you have a custom that I release someone for you at the Passover. Do you wish then that I release for you the king of the Jews? Now, this was a custom from the Hasmonean era, when the political criminals at that time were continually increasing. And it was something that was practiced back then during the days of Jesus. This was seen as a continued privilege after the Romans took over Palestine. And so he's asking, you want Barabbas or Jesus? Now, to us, the answer seems obvious. But from the eyes of those envious, bloodthirsty Jews, both men were terrible. So what I suspect that Pilate is trying to do here is I suspect he's trying to play the lesser of two evils cards. Sure, to the Sanhedrin, Jesus was a blasphemer and he was stealing all of their popularity, all of their limelight. But Barabbas? I mean, gross. This guy's awful. He instigated rebellion. He committed murder. Surely the Jews wouldn't want this monster back on the street. But you know, the gospel records is so full of just dramatic irony. Verse 18 says, so they cried out all together, saying, away with this man and release for us Barabbas. And once again, it just exposes the Jews' hypocrisy. If the Jews were really concerned about an insurrection against Rome like they were charging Jesus with, they wouldn't have wanted a man released who was caught red-handed doing it. But the level of contempt they had for Jesus just ran too deep. And though Pilate exposes their hypocrisy, he is once again outwitted by the Jews. Here's a bonus one for you. You know what the word Barabbas means? It means son of the father. That's what the word literally means. Bar being son of, Abba, father. Isn't it interesting that they wanted a man whose literal name meant Son of the Father instead of the one who was actually the Son of God? So Matthew 27, 22 through 23. Pilate says to them, "What shall I do with Jesus who is called Christ?" And they all said, "Crucify him." And he said, "Why, what evil has he done?" But they kept shouting all the more, saying, "Crucify him." Pilate's going to try a second strategy here. I told you there are three things. Here's the second one. He's going to try to reason with them. The law of Moses taught that any punishment given to a Jew was to be proportional to the crime committed. That's why we see it all in Deuteronomy 19:21, eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. In other words, that law placed limitations on the punishment inflicted. If someone cuts off my finger, I may, in a fit of emotion, want to take both of his arms, but the law would prevent that reaction. But these Jews, out of pure ill intent, want to enforce the worst punishment imaginable on Jesus. You know, crucifixion wasn't the only way to kill a criminal at the time. In fact, it wasn't even the way that Jews killed their own people. They never practiced crucifixion. The closest thing they did to it was the posthumous hanging of the victim on a tree after being stoned to death as an insult to injury to render the offense more hideous, which Paul refers to in Galatians. But they never practiced crucifixion, not as the Romans did. Roman crucifixion, as we're going to look at in detail tomorrow, was the most horrible and most brutal form of torture that a man could experience, only reserved for the worst of criminals. And not deeming Jesus even worthy of a capital punishment according to their own Jewish traditions, they request this horrible punishment for him. And I get the idea from reading this verse right here that Pilate is almost shocked. I mean, he's almost shocked. Why? What evil has he done? What crime has this man committed of such maliciousness that you'd have me ordered to be tortured to death in the most heinous way imaginable? And their response to that? Crucify him. These Jews with their mob mentality were fortunately beyond reason. And so he tries a third strategy. And the strategy is, what if then I satisfy their bloodlust by having him punished severely? What if I have him scourged? Now, scourging always preceded a crucifixion, but I think that the evidence is strong, and we'll talk about this in a little bit more detail tomorrow. I think the evidence is strong that Pilate intended Jesus' scourging to be the full punishment inflicted, merely to satisfy the bloodlust of the Jews. So in other words, the lesser of two cards thing didn't work. I can't reason with them. They're beyond reason. So I'll scourge this Galilean within an inch of his life and then display his humiliation before them all. Maybe, just maybe, that will satisfy them. And so John 19, verse 1 says that Pilate then took Jesus and scourged him. Again, my purpose tonight is not to get into the medical details of what Jesus experienced in the scourging. We're going to get into that somewhat tomorrow. But here is why I believe Christ's crucifixion was especially bad. First, he didn't even have the strength, brethren, to carry his own cross to Calvary. They had to enlist the help of a passerby, Simon of Cyrene, to carry it. Second, most victims in crucifixion typically lasted for days on the cross. Jesus only lasted about 6 hours. And when he finally died, Mark 15, verse 44 says that Pilate was actually surprised that he was already dead. Victims normally lasted a lot longer than 6 hours. But third, victims were typically escorted straight from the scourging to Calvary. And Pilate brings out Jesus again to present him before the people, a bloody, humiliated, physical wreck. And so my suspicion is that he was hoping that this would quell their bloodlust and their appetite so we could let him go. That's my suspicion. John 19, verse 2 says the soldiers twisted together a crown of thorns and put it on his head, and put a purple robe on him, and they began to come up to him and say, "Hail, King of the Jews," and to give him slaps to the face. Pilate came out again and said to them, "Behold, I am bringing him out to you, so that you may know that I find no guilt in him." And Jesus then came out wearing the crown of thorns and purple robe. And Pilate said to them, "Behold the man." Now, this is the second time that Pilate has declared Jesus' innocence. And now he's doing so again when he shouldn't even have to. He's presenting to them a brutally scourged and humiliated man. Behold, the man! Does this look like a king to you? A threat? Surely you can see how broken he is. Will you finally be satisfied in his undoing? Nope. Their cruelty is just truly repugnant. John 19, verse 6 says, so when the chief priests and the officers saw him, saw the bloody wreck, when they saw that, they cried out again, crucify, crucify. You know, folks, I've been wounded and oppressed, and I've experienced the temptation of personal vengeance, but I cannot imagine wanting my worst enemy to endure the kind of suffering death that they are proposing for Jesus. I can't imagine it. And Pilate says, take him for yourselves and crucify him, for I find no guilt in him. This is the third time that he's pronounced Jesus' innocence. How ironic that it was not a Jew, but a Roman pagan who beheld the Lamb of God without blemish and without spot. And I suspect Pilate is probably mocking them. He knew they didn't have the authority to carry out crucifixion. They knew it too, which is probably why they continue to try to manipulate Pilate further. Saying in verse 7, we have a law, and by that law he ought to die because he made himself out to be the Son of God. See, now their true beef with Jesus is made evident. In other words, this was no political issue as they tried to sell him on in the beginning. It's a religious issue. They didn't like who Christ proclaimed himself to be, and Pilate now realizes that no matter how hard he tries to release him, the Jews won't have it. The Jews' true motive has been exposed. But that doesn't seem to bother Pilate. But what they say about Jesus, that seems to scare him. Because in verse 8 it says that, therefore, when Pilate heard this statement, he was even more afraid. And I suspect that what Pilate is really afraid of here is, I suspect he's afraid of Jesus. Now, on the surface, that doesn't seem justifiable. He's bloody, he's beaten, he's weak, he's seemingly harmless, a caricature of a king, and about to be condemned, and yet Pilate's afraid. And I do suspect he's afraid of Jesus. Now, some will deny this and make the argument that Romans would have had no concept of what it meant to be the Son of God, but I actually disagree with that. The Roman centurion, seeing how Jesus died, would say in Matthew 27, verse 54, truly this was the Son of God. The soldiers who came to arrest Jesus in John 18, verse 6, fell to the ground when Jesus proclaimed, I am. I mean, their understanding would have certainly been limited, but not completely absent. And Pilate is being told that this man, who he could already tell was not ordinary, has claimed to be the Son of God. While Pilate has already pronounced Jesus' innocence three times, he proceeds to hold a second inquiry with Jesus, illegal, since the first one had already brought about the verdict of guilt, of not guilty. We read in verse 9 that he entered into the praetorium again and said to Jesus, where are you from? But Jesus gave him no answer. Now, during the first inquiry, Jesus spoke with Pilate. He worked on Pilate. But Pilate had his chance to release him and instead took the coward's way out. But with all the pride of a Roman, Pilate says in verse 10, you do not speak to me? Do you not know that I have authority to release you and authority to crucify you? Jesus responds in verse 7, you would have no authority over me unless it had been given you from above. For this reason, he who delivered me to you has the greater sin. And these, brethren, are the last words that Jesus would utter during his trial. Yes, you have authority, Pilate, but it is temporary, borrowed authority from above. The Jewish authorities are the ones who delivered Jesus to Pilate, and so theirs is the greater sin. But by using these words, he is telling Pilate that he shares responsibility for this mockery of a trial. And this confidence and composure in Jesus, given his condition, given his fate, given who he is standing before, it's not lost on Pilate. Pilate had sentenced many men to death, but I suspect no man was ever as confidently composed in his last hours as Jesus of Nazareth. So in John 12, 19 and verse 12, he says, as a result of this, Pilate made efforts to release him. It's as if Pilate has a conscience, imagine that. But he does. Just like you and I. You see, brethren, every single one of us will stand in Pilate's sandals at some point where we're going to have to choose whether we're going to stand with Christ, accepting whatever consequences come our way, or stand with the world. And brethren, just as with Pilate, standing with Christ is not going to be pretty. Sometimes it's going to be humiliating. Sometimes it's going to look ugly. And if we choose to stand with Him, the world is not going to take it easy on us. The Jews did not make it easy on Pilate. It says the Jews cried out, saying, "If you release this man, you are no friend of Caesar. And everyone who makes himself out to be king opposes Caesar." In other words, if you stand with Jesus, it's going to cost you. The Jews had already petitioned Tiberius once about Pilate. A second petition by them, especially of this nature, might cost Pilate more than his governorship. See, it's one thing, brethren, to want to stand with Christ. It's one thing for us to say that we will, to sing that we will, or to pray that we will. Pilate wanted to release Jesus. No question. He wanted to. The question is, for us, is when the consequences of having that kind of integrity are staring us in the face, will our love and our loyalty to Jesus surpass our fears? And unfortunately for Pilate, he failed the test. As in Matthew 27, verse 24, it says, "When Pilate saw that he was accomplishing nothing, but rather that a riot was starting, he took water and washed his hands in front of the crowd, saying, 'I am innocent of this man's blood. See to that yourselves.' And all the people said, 'His blood shall be on us and on our children.'" And you know, for the first time in this trial, the Jews are correct and Pilate is wrong. Yes, for the Jews, Christ's blood would indeed be on them and on their children by way of consequence as well as for their potential salvation. But Pilate is wrong. Proclaiming your own innocence doesn't make you innocent, just as proclaiming Jesus' innocence did not set them free. It matters not what we say. It matters in what we stand. And it matters in who we stand with. I have really taken up a lot of time tonight. I'm so sorry. I just think some of these things are so important to talk about. I want you to just bear with me for two or three more minutes and we'll conclude. Just a couple more minutes. As Jesus was delivered over to the Jews to be crucified, never once did Pilate announce a verdict of guilty. Three times he proclaimed his innocence. In all three phases of the Jewish trials, it was a verdict of guilty, guilty, guilty. And in all three phases of the Roman trial, it was innocent, innocent, innocent. How ironic. As John 1 and verse 11 tells us, he came to his own, and those who were his own did not receive him. Every criminal defense attorney, even today, has to deal with the question of all questions that he gets asked, and you probably thought about this before too, and that question is, how can you defend a person you know to be guilty? How would you answer that question? I don't know how I would answer that question unless I knew how this guy I'm about to show you answered the question. There was a man by the name of William Blackstone in 1765, and he answered it in this way. "It is better that 10 guilty persons escape than one innocent suffer." But in the trial of Jesus Christ, it's just not one innocent man suffering, is it? It is the ultimate of all innocent men suffering, so that countless of us who are guilty can be set free. What a paradox. Did you know that there's a seventh phase to Jesus' trial? And can you guess what it is? It's the phase where you and I are the judges, and we have to decide what we're going to do with Jesus. Jesus is calling us to be actors in the drama, defenders, judge, and jury. And what will we do with Jesus? As we do as the Jews did and deny that He's our Lord, tear our clothes metaphorically, try to convince others of the same? Or we can do as Pilate did and proclaim His innocence, and we can fear the implications of Him possibly being the Son of God, yet when it comes down to actually serving Him, decide, you know, this is going to cost me too much. But choose we must, and choose we will. And you know, not making a choice is also a choice. Many simply stood on the sidelines of Jesus' trial and said and did nothing while justice was trampled upon on the very feast day where God's mercy should have been dominant in the mind of every single Jew. But determining our own verdict and living that verdict is going to be directly proportional to the outcome of our own trial with which we will be served when we appear before God's judgment seat. And when that day comes, what verdict will the great judge of all the ages render you? You know, it's too late for Annas. It's too late for Caiaphas. It's too late for many of the ones in that time who had a chance to take their stand. Herod, Pilate, their place in eternity, it's sealed. It's sealed. But tonight, while this earth remains, if you're not a Christian, it's not too late for you. And that's my encouragement to you tonight. If you are not a Christian and you believe that Jesus is the Son of God, and you're willing to confess that before men, and you think that's hard, you don't know what hard is. That's cake. That's a cakewalk. That's all that Jesus wants. In addition to us repenting of our sins and being baptized in water to have our sins washed away. You can do that tonight. I tell you, folks, compared to what Jesus went through, we're getting it off pretty easy. He deserves everything we've got. And you have an opportunity to give him that tonight if you're not a Christian. Won't you come forward and make it known that you would like to become one as we stand in heaven?